The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today I am interviewing Charlotte Big Canoe from The Full Plate. And there's so much to get into. But first, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, so we're going to discuss some serious important issues. Also, things I want to learn about indigenous rights and how that relates to the world of wine. It's a concept, it's a topic I've never even thought about before. So I'm excited. But instead of starting there, we're going to start with, you got like a funky bottle of Riesling from Uber Eats. What a world are we living in?
This is a really great testament to this kind of crazy world we're in Ontario right now. But we're now able to sell alcohol with takeout. So a lot of places have their wine now up on Uber Eats. And I ordered a bottle of Riesling from Langhe. So it's an Italian Riesling from Barolo region. And I got it on Uber Eats from Italy with a bit of bread and some mozzarella. So
okay.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually told me that it was on there, and I went and grabbed a bottle because I was pretty interested. So
have you tried it yet? Because in that region, you know, you won't, if you're going to think white wine, you might think Gavi, you know, or our niece, you know, there's some, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, but you know, there's certain, you know, grapes you think of in that region. You don't usually think of Riesling when you think of Barolo, Nebbiolo country, you know, up in Piemonte. How have you tried it yet?
So we actually, this was part of a much larger Riesling tasting I did with a couple of friends who are also big wine nerds. But when you think about it, that region produces a lot of wines that retain acid really, really well. So when you think about Riesling and kind of the bits of that grape that you love, acid being the main part of it, it makes sense. It definitely isn't as deeply doesn't have as much Riesling characteristics as ones that we're familiar with, but it's kind of an enjoyable white wine. We describe it as like a poolside crusher, you know, for a hot day. So that's what it is.
I like poolside crusher is so much better than barbecue wine. You ever notice, like, when people are trying to sell maybe not the best wine, it's always either pizza wine or it's barbecue wine. They always use those two descriptors.
Yeah, it's kind of comfort food wine. But this one, I think, just is like a easy, kind of fun, crisp white wine. It's much more interesting because of the region and where it's coming from than actually what's in the glass when you get tasting it. But I enjoy it, so why not?
All right. And this is so sad. I wasn't going to drink any wine, but you sat down with yours. So I quickly grabbed some white Clos and Chase Chardonnay. So that's all right. But you win the cool person wine contest between the two of us.
I'll take that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, actually, you know what? We'll go there now. Just the news broke. When we're recording this, it's October 8th. This will be released in a couple weeks. But the news broke just a day or so ago that the Ontario government is now going to allow for restaurants to still sell bottles of wine to consumers. I think this is fantastic news. I'm so happy for, you know, a mutual friend of ours, Heather McDougall, and the work she's doing with Grand Cru Deli. And I'm wondering, for someone who works in hospitality, what does this mean for restaurants?
So this is huge. Having that legislation that came out when the pandemic hit, being able to sell single bottles of wine with food was great because it's always been something that is lacking in our ability to purchase wine and spirits in Ontario. And so we'll get into this later because I do a lot of work around the history of the LCBO and kind of the role they play in our view of Indigenous people as well as our relationship to alcohol. But kind of having them give up the reins a little bit and allow us to sell alcohol at our doors is huge. And because a lot of people, their relationship with their restaurants and the places they go is often based on how much they love the wine list. Like, there's so many times where you go out and you say, oh, we got to go here, they have a great wine list. Now we're able to still engage with the places in that way and then be at home if we need to. And it gives you just so much more excitement about what you can pick up. Like, again, for an example, I sat on my couch and ordered a bottle of wine and bread and a fresh thing of mozzarella to my house. That's crazy. There's never a moment that that's been a thing. Like, I remember, still complete sidebar, but I remember sitting with my younger brother and saying, when we were kids, wouldn't it be cool if you could get McDonald's delivered? And then just now to see all the things that happen, being able to sell alcohol gives you just a huge new revenue stream. And Heather is a great example of that. She's building all these programs that are now around this ability to sell alcohol with food. She's taken it into kind of new stretches and putting together like tasting experiences and groups and things like that, because we're able to start working around these laws that the LCBO has had in place. So it's really exciting. It's going to be big changes for this industry.
I've often described the LCBO and the Ontario government when it comes to how they view wine and how they view wine in relationship with the populace as they are part draconian and they are part paternalistic, where it's these hardcore rules and they're worried about, oh, well, if we allow more flexibility, more progressiveness in terms of being able to get access to wine, what's that going to do to the populace? And then you go to so many other parts of the world where you can buy a bottle of wine anywhere, and I look around the streets, I'm like, huh, no one's burning down every building. It seems they managed to survive. And here in Ontario, it took a pandemic to loosen things up.
Which is actually really interesting, because the LCBO's history is with temperance in Ontario. So the LCBO was formed in 1927 after our Prohibition Act. So they've had a really big relationship when it comes to surveillance and control of alcohol within the province. And that's kind of evolved over time as to what they've been able to gain control of and what they've given up. So prior to this, you know, the sale of alcohol, you would see a lot of sales of international wine, because if I'm importing it into my restaurant, if I want to sell, for example, this Riesling, I have to pay taxes on it. It has to go through the LCBO. Whereas if I bring in a Canadian wine or an Ontario wine, I should say Ontario wine, because interprovincial trade with wine is a whole other problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ontario wine, I can buy it direct from the winery. Like when I order Pearl Morissette, I order it directly from Pearl Morissette. So I'm removing the LCBO's ability to make money on that, in a sense. There's still the licensees and things that are still collecting money off that. But it's very interesting to look from where they started in 1927, all of the things that have changed in how they've operated to this moment now, where we're seeing another really big change that has happened because of a viral pandemic and the way that our economy has been impacted, where it started with Prohibition and the end of wars and how the economy was impacted then. So it's, you really see how much, like, yes, it is about alcohol, but it is so, so much more about money and the way that that changes with what's happening with the populace over time.
Yeah, and there's something about it whenever they, I don't want to say brag, but when they put out their press release about how much money they made, I'm like, you have the easiest product to sell and you have a close to a complete monopoly. Your logo could be someone with a steel-toed boot kicking a puppy and you're still going to make money. Nothing is going to stop you from making lots and lots of money.
It's crazy. They make so much money, and you know, like the LCBO really, when it comes down to it, is much more of a surveillance state than anything. Like they're really, really kind of holding the reins tight on what people can drink, what they can consume, where they can consume it. And all those things really come into play with the LCBO. So being able to now have something like Heather's shop, like Sips on Richmond, where I can walk in and get some product that you could never get a hold of before, and take single bottles home and not have to deal with a full case, which oftentimes for people isn't necessarily financially feasible, is so exciting. And I used to, prior to working in wine, I used to work in spirits. And oh my God, that it is impossible to get some really great bourbons and things up from the US because of these laws, and because of, it doesn't make sense for the distillery to send them up to us because they lose money. Like it's just, it's really, really tough when you exist in Ontario to run a beverage program that you're really excited by. Like you do this dance all the time.
Yeah. And it's so funny. Whenever you travel, any winery I've been to in Spain, in Italy, France, California, when you say you're from Ontario, the person always gives a certain stink face, or they always give a, like this exhausted expression.
Yeah. It's a headache to deal with. And so this is going to, maybe not make the biggest change when it comes to taxes and imports and all of that, but for your home consumer, this is exciting. You're going to get engage with a lot more product and with people who like really want you to come and purchase it too. That's the other thing that's exciting is now the people who are able to sell these bottles are people who've worked in the industry for a long time and have such an affinity for them that you're purchasing from a different group of people too. So I don't know, I always talk about education and wine and stuff. It's like social currency and cachet, and people want that. People want to bring the cool bottle. Like I won the award today for the coolest bottle. Everybody wants that. So yeah, you now get to go into these places and have somebody kind of sell you on that who like loves their list and loves they can sell the product. So it's really exciting. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I wish I had some sort of like Bulgarian, you know, single vineyard Cab Franc, you know, that's organic winery. Anyway, and also the great thing about this is if this helps you, if you can help support restaurants, like my favorite restaurants, I'll now go and I'll buy a bottle of wine. My favorite Italian joint, you know, I'll buy something from Sicily, or if I have a little more money, a Barbaresco or something, and it helps.
Absolutely.
So you know, that's a big thing as well.
I think I'm seeing a lot, just for a good suggestion to put in your head, is when you go out for dinner, just ask them if they'll, you can add a bottle and just start collecting that way. Like if you're already there, you're on the premise, just pick one up, they'll add it to your bill, you take it home, you don't have to necessarily purchase takeout because you've already purchased food, and off you go, and you don't necessarily have to make a trip to the LCBO. So
yeah,
be exciting.
Yep. So let's get a little bit about you, but first the website, the nonprofit group that you are a big part of, the Full Plate, which is providing help for people that work within the industry to help hospitality workers and to, you know, trying to give for free access to mental health, fitness, and general wellness. It's something that was a big part of my conversation with Heather McDougall a little while back, and that's how she connected us. So I'd love to hear more about this organization, what you guys do.
Yeah, so the organization is called Full Plate. We're a nonprofit based in Toronto. So it was really started by a good friend of mine, Sarah Bailey, and she asked me to come on in January. So this was actually started prior to the pandemic. You know, a lot of these things have kind of started to pop up because we're really taking a reflective look at our industry and kind of what needs to change. This was something that she had been thinking about for a long time and invited me to join her earlier this year. And then once the pandemic really hit in Ontario, we had all of a sudden a lot of free time. So we were able to get quite a few things going. And it is, to be honest, much harder now that I'm back working a lot. I wish I was much more frequently involved. But we've been able to really create some cool partnerships. So for example, we do work with Foodshare TO. So we provide produce boxes to hospitality workers free of charge delivered to your door. So we know that oftentimes people who work in restaurants sometimes can't even afford to eat in the restaurant they work at. So there's a huge disparity there. And we want to make sure that if we are addressing things like mental health and wellness, we're doing it with an intersectional lens to kind of really look at, if you're struggling with your mental health, I can provide you mental health services. That's one thing. But then I also want to make sure I'm looking at kind of what the precarity of this work is and how it affects hospitality workers and why they need these mental health services as well. So not just necessarily only giving a Band-Aid fix. One of our projects we have coming up, so I'm really excited about, is our hospitality kitchen. So we're going to be doing kind of an expansion on the produce boxes that we do, where we have some chefs coming in and donating their time and cooking meals for hospitality staff for them to pick up for free. We kind of have the first round of that happening next Monday. So a harvest dinner on Thanksgiving Monday at a bar in Toronto where bring your own container. So it's very green, no takeout disposal boxes. And we've cooked up a bunch of turkeys and stuff and you can fill up and get a meal if you need to. So we're going to be doing a series of that throughout the next coming months and people can drop in whenever they want and get some food if they need to and check out some food from different chefs. So we'll be a different featured chef every time and they'll be there cooking up for everybody.
That's great. Well, let's stay on this for a second. You mentioned mental health. What are some of the common, I don't want to use the word complaints. That feels mm-hmm. like I'm not giving it the attention or the gravitas it deserves. But when people are having issues with mental health, when it comes to their relationship with work, what are some of the common maladies?
I think it can be pretty complex in hospitality, and it depends on obviously your personal experience with it. But a lot of times there's a stigma around this role. Sometimes there's people who don't necessarily respect it or don't give it the respect it deserves. So you can feel kind of put out by society or kind of not valued in the same way. And like the hospitality industry employs so many people across Canada. We're on par with manufacturing by large numbers. And yet it's just, it's not a role that often gets the respect it deserves and for the amount it brings to the economy. So people can feel ashamed about their job. Maybe if they're going back to their family or to their friends or to whoever they're close to, maybe they don't feel as excited about their job in comparison to someone else. And that affects the way that you view yourself and the way that you engage with your work. It's also too, like for myself, it is hard to serve people all the time. Sometimes that can really drain on you to spend a lot of your days bringing food to people and taking it away and cleaning up. And that kind of work can be really hard. And you don't often get treated in the way that you think. Like I love hospitality. I think one of the best things about it is people come to us on their greatest days. They come to us to celebrate birthdays and weddings and all of that. And they also come on their worst days to get cheered up. But if, you know, you've had a bad day at work, maybe you want to go have a drink at a bar and sit and see the people that you love. But that's not always every interaction. Some interactions can be really, really painful. I work in education outside of this and in hospitality, and I've experienced more racism in hospitality than anywhere in my life. So it can be something that as much as you love it and come in and get excited with the food and drink that you get to serve, you also are dealing with the general public, and that comes with kind of a lack of control in the interactions that might happen to you. So it's also late hours, it's long days, it's not often falling within labor laws, there's not often paid breaks, and things like that really do start to drain on you, and your physical health and mental health are so tied that if you're struggling in your job and you often don't have benefits, there's not really seen as an option of another way to care for yourself. So we want to make sure that if we're talking about mental health, it's recognizing that you can really, like, burnout is a huge issue in this industry. More oftentimes you either age out or burnout is the saying. So that's a clear problem. That's a issue that the workers are facing all the time. It's sometimes dismissed as just work that students do and then they get a real job and they leave, which also, again, creates that level of disrespect. So I think in hospitality, you can have all those issues, and that's honestly a small part of it. Like, there's also issues when it comes to back of house staff. Like, that's something that's been in the news a lot, is that there's a huge kind of power disparity between chefs and their back of house workers. And, you know, there's HR complaints that I won't name names, but you can Google kind of things that have happened there. So it's not necessarily the most, always the most positive work environment. And so a lot of people right now are kind of taking that introspective look to say, okay, our industry is broken. There's a lot of problems that are happening here. And, you know, disrespect is not something that's only dragged in like mud from the guests. It does happen between the workers as well. And if we're going to address that, we got to make sure we're really supporting the workers.
Yeah. Well, when I was talking to Heather, and I'll reiterate this, is that for people out there, and it's something that I'm doing now, is, you know, doing the Google, doing the research. And if there is restaurant groups or sort of places where there has been rampant amounts of disrespect within the restaurant, then choose somewhere else or go to that place and say, I'm not coming back here and supporting you until you clean up your house. Because there's 4,000 restaurants. There's tons of options out there. You know, but what I wanted to ask you, Charlotte, is what would you tell people that go to restaurants in terms of how they interact with staff? What can people do to at least try to reduce that level of mental distress that sometimes is on the people working there, to make their job, the people doing the serving and the taking of plates? What can people like myself do to just make the work environment just even a little bit more positive?
Honestly, the thing that is always most memorable to me with people I have is guests who are actually excited to be there. Like, and I know that's not always the case. I don't mean if you're having a bad day that you have to suck it up and be the nicest person in the world. I would hope that you would, because you are still interacting with somebody else. But I think oftentimes, because this work can be so disrespected, people forget that servers are people. So I don't know if you saw recently in the news, but the Ontario chief medical officer, when asked about community spread with restaurants, said he hasn't noticed that there's been community spread linked to restaurants. All the outbreaks he's seen have been linked to the staff. And
what?
Yes, which is very bizarre. Because
so basically, he's put. Sorry to interrupt. He's he or she, I don't know who that individual is. I apologize, but they're putting a higher status on the people going in the restaurant and not the humans working in the restaurant.
So, and the pandemic has really, really highlighted this. Like, for example, we had a gentleman a few evenings ago who came in and was very upset about the fact that we require contact tracing information, which a whole other aside is kind of crazy. We now have to take every single guest information, but Toronto has halted all contact tracing. So more work for me, but that's okay. But he was very upset about it, said the pandemic was millennials' fault and things like that. And
oh, I think God.
People, when they read these statistics that young people are getting COVID much more now, don't realize that a lot of young people don't have work from home jobs. And like myself, I interact with hundreds of plus people a day who are not wearing masks because they're in a restaurant. So, you know, especially in the pandemic, like recognizing that this is precarious work and that I and everybody else who works here is really putting their health at risk to make sure somebody can have a bowl of pasta or a glass of wine. So I think it's kind of giving them that respect to say, you know, thank you for doing this and taking the time to just be kind and pleasant and listen to them. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't think that you need to go out of your way to have conversation with them, because sometimes that is draining too when you spend all day talking to everybody. But just having a little patience and a little respect and understanding that a lot of the stuff that's happening right now, like limited menus or patio dining or patios that don't have heaters, is really out of that person's control. And that dining out really is a luxury, and kind of treating it as such and giving them the respect that they deserve to be there so that you can enjoy that evening.
And I don't have to be as kind as you. The people out there that get upset about putting their names, you people are assholes.
Oh,
you
I know.
You people are narcissists. You people, it's horrible. My girlfriend's twin sister works at a restaurant, Relish on Danforth. And one person wrote Peter Pan, and someone wrote, you know, just all these different fictional characters. And it's so disrespectful for the people that work in restaurants. And yeah, my advice is yeah, you don't want to talk the ear off of the server because they got a lot of other people, but be patient, be kind, and try to go in with a positive spirit, because it just through osmosis, it's going to help.
And honestly, if they ask you if you want to hear the specials, just say yes, because
yes,
just say yes. Like, please, come on.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think.
Wait, people again, say no?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
I've never said no. That's ridiculous. I'm curious. I want to know what your specials are.
Oh, no, people say it all the time. And I that's what I mean. Like, you know, reopening in the pandemic has been really interesting. We started at the restaurant I work at with very small menu, limited, to give the chefs some time to see how they could distance with each other and to see what was doable in the kitchen. And it just cracks me up that immediately after reopening, we would get some reviews that said, like, limited menu was better before the pandemic. Like, it's just, it's hilarious. But you know what? That is also the reality. And that's what I mean is the work kind of facing with general public. Like, you get a gamut of responses. And so you eventually do steel yourself to them, but that affects your mental health. Like, the response is not necessarily just to put up a thicker skin. Like, that's not the response we want to have for our team, but you do sometimes have to laugh.
The person that wrote limited menus better before the pandemic, that's the person on TripAdvisor that stays in a great suite in a great resort, but they complain because they didn't get enough towels.
And 100%. Yeah, absolutely.
80% of their review is on the towels that they felt weren't fluffy enough.
Yeah, I've been joking that because now there's some potential that outdoor dining will be quote unquote year round, which I'm not totally sure what that means. I don't know if that means we're getting funding for heaters, because otherwise, what's the point? I don't know if it means an extension of the Cafe TO program into the winter. If it doesn't mean heaters, I am just envisioning reviews that say things like came out to dine, sat on the patio because of COVID, and it couldn't believe I was outside. Like, if my server has to wear a jacket, it's too cold for me to dine out. And you're like, what? So I'm anticipating a lot of that come the winter season as we try to navigate how to safely exist in this industry, as a lot of calls right now are going against indoor dining, which I don't totally disagree with. But it does create a whole new kind of puzzle piece for you to figure out of how do you keep going through the winter season. I don't think a lot of us thought we'd still be doing this and looking down December.
Yeah, and I want to get there. By the way, I can't wait for the first review from February. The place was nice, but it was cold. Why was it cold? Well, it's Canada. It's February. I heard that what's going on? I don't know if with Full Plate petitioning the House of Commons for worker protections with patios closing.
Yeah, so there's a group that we've started with Full Plate as well as others called the Canadian Restaurant Workers Coalition. So it's a group of nonprofits that came together to advocate for workers, especially as we're starting to see potential problems with patios closing with the cold, with calls for indoor dining shutting down. So we're going to be working on something to lobby the government on behalf of the workers. It's not quite live yet, but it is happening soon. We do have a survey to start collecting data to inform that. So we want to make sure that if we are lobbying for the workers, we're using their opinions to inform that work. I believe it is on our Instagram if you go to @thefullplate on there. And then we're going to collect those responses and kind of really look at what the sector of workers needs and how we can best address that. So it's a group of hospitality-based nonprofits working together.
How worried are you for not just, by the way, people don't know, Charlotte, where do you work?
So I work at Askari King Street. I wonder if I should say that after talking about the bad reviews, but I work on Askari.
It's great. the first time I was there was years ago when I was out of work for a little period I work for a TSN 1050 and it's radio. It can be transient. And so there was a brief period. I've been very lucky where I was out of work and I went there because it was like a Monday and it was like half price wine. And I'm like, well, I'm still going out, but I'm going to save money. I recommend everyone. You guys got a great list. You got a great bottle shop. I still have one of your Shannons that I want to find more of. Really just a great Cab Franc. So it's a really good place. Highly, highly, highly recommend people check it out. I want to get into this. I was looking at your bio and just about you do work as an Indigenous art educator at the Art Gallery of Toronto. And we talked a little bit about this before, but the relationship between wine regions, terroir, and the Indigenous people of Ontario, I never thought about this. I never even thought about any of the connections to it. And, you know, I didn't want to ask you too much about it when we talked on the phone ages ago, because I kind of wanted to learn more about it during this podcast. I was wondering if you could expand on that.
Yeah. So I work at the Art Gallery of Ontario, do their Indigenous art education. So I do that for school-age children as well as adults. Like, we have corporate groups come through all the time. And so that work really is based around decolonizing the art space. So looking at talking about Indigenous art as art and less as artifact, which often is how it's viewed. And so that work has really started to inform my work in hospitality, as I've started to look at the history of things like the Indian Act. And I will say, as a caveat, if we're going to talk about the Indian Act, I'm going to use the term Indian a lot, but for everybody listening, it's not a term that is politically correct or well used. I prefer to identify as Indigenous, as do many other groups. But if I do say the term Indian to describe the group of people, it is based around that piece of law and not based around identifying myself for that group of people. But as I started to really look at that through an arts-focused lens and history of the Indian Act and status and reservations and the residential school system, it started to really overlap with kind of our Canadian wine region. So, for example, just as a quick thing, and we can kind of work through this history if you'd like, but the Indian Act is really predated by this thing called the Royal Proclamation of, I think, 1764 or so. So it was by King George III, and this was after the end of the Seven Years' War. So once that happened, France had to give up all of their land in Canada. And he made this royal proclamation where, in part, it talks about how Indigenous land is, if not purchased or ceded by them, is to be left alone, as is their hunting grounds. That is their land. They're not to be touched. The group is not to be disturbed. So it kind of sets up the policies and the idea around ceded, like, colonial land and Indigenous land. So one of the things that is kind of a weird view that we have is that Canada was quote-unquote conquered or something. But it wasn't really conquered. It was always based around this agreement of a nation-to-nation agreement of Indigenous people as well as settlers. And that all of that happening, the Royal Proclamation, was then taken and announced with a group in Ontario at the Treaty of Fort Niagara. So that was really kind of the first bit of agreements in Canada post the Royal Proclamation was in Niagara. And so there's a really deep history in the Niagara wine region around Indigenous land and Indigenous rights that doesn't really get talked about when we talk about terroir and wine regions in Ontario. However, if we go to somewhere like Alsace, we can't talk about Alsace without talking about what's happened with the wars and how that border has flip-flopped so many times and who's owned that land and why it's changed. We don't really do that in Canada. We don't take a look at how that land was not Indigenous land at some point and then started to become a wine region or a winery. So I think we're really kind of whitewashing the history of Canada when we talk about Canadian wine regions as only existing as wine regions and when they started to make wine, and not looking at things such as treaties and such as enfranchisement from Indigenous people where they weren't able to own land unless they gave up their status. So there's all these kind of things that play into who owns that land that we don't really talk about in relationship to our wine. And wine is something that is so tied to the land. Like that's kind of how you start studying it, is geographically. So I would love to kind of start having that conversation around Canadian wine and just recognizing the history of the land from which we get these grapes and this great wine.
Where would you like to see it in a couple, like 10 years from now, in terms of the consumer and the consumer's knowledge of the history of where, like this glass of Clos and Chase Chardonnay, that actually the grapes, I think this is a Niagara one. Yeah, this is a Niagara River VQA. So what would you hope for that in a 5 years or whatever that I know about this wine beyond limestone and slightly malolactic fermentation?
Well, I think that's like twofold. So one thing I think nobody in Canada knows enough about the Indian Act and kind of what that piece of law dictates and what it means about my identity versus your identity. And I, first of all, would love everybody to kind of learn a little bit more about that and recognize that it isn't only for Indigenous people, it is for everybody in Canada. And then secondly, with that education and that relationship to that glass of Chardonnay that you're drinking, for the winery to know whose land they're on. If you went to the winery, how different would it be if they greeted you and said, welcome, this is lot 45 or whatever. We are on the land of the Haudenosaunee, the Wendat, and most recently Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, for example. So having it be something that's readily accessible and knowledgeable from whoever's making the wine to whoever's drinking the wine just starts to put First Nations and Indigenous people in the conversation around the land. So often I find anytime I start to talk about my Indigenous identity with groups, I get all these questions that kind of remind me that people almost think Indigenous people don't exist anymore, or like I'm an alien or a cartoon. Like the questions I get are almost trying to suss out if it's for real, which is very interesting, but it does highlight how little people know. So I would love it to be just much more common and easy and a part of what Canada is and who we are as Canadians to know that Niagara is Haudenosaunee land and Toronto is Wendat and Anishinaabe, and we know where we are because we're respecting the land that we're on. And I don't know if that means getting the VQA to make it part of their appellations and part of their education on that. But then that means that everybody who isn't VQA doesn't necessarily have to engage in the same way. And I don't want it to be just in one box, but I do think if we are going to look at something like the VQA and really look at appellations and kind of command respect for them, we can't do that without also acknowledging that land.
I like the analogy there of you mentioned about Alsace. It's a great example that, you know, or when we talk about Champagne, you know, and we talk about world wars and, this land was German, it was French, it was German, like that. That is sort of intertwined in the bottle. So then it feels to me that this, you know, for it to hit the, like, which basically you want it to be normalized. So this is just part of the conversation. It seems like that's part on the government. That's part on the wineries and maybe also part on restaurants with staff training as well, just to try, like, it seems like it would take so many different organizations to try to get what you probably want accomplished.
It does. And you know what, I've been talking to a good friend of mine, she's incredible and runs a really, really great program in Toronto, about doing kind of just that on their wine list. So looking at how to indicate regions in Canadian wine on the list and acknowledge the Indigenous people of those regions as well. So I think there's also one of the, depending on who you ask, successes of the Indian Act or failures, in my opinion, failure, is that it's created this barrier between Indigenous people and the people of Canada that they're so afraid of talking about anything Indigenous for fear of being incorrect. So a lot of the work I do at the gallery is around art and appropriation. And that's a huge issue, is appropriation of Indigenous art and culture. And absolutely it is. And I don't want to support it by any means, but I also don't want to exist in a world where you're so scared of talking about Indigenous issues that you can't even say that, you can't even do a land acknowledgement in hospitality. Like I don't want people to be so scared of talking about Indigenous existence. It just is essentially creates forgetting. Like the least we talk about it, the more easy it is to forget.
How much of that do you think is fear that someone's like, they're going to say the wrong thing and then they're going to feel that they're going to quote unquote get in trouble or something, which I think is sometimes overblown.
I think it really depends on the person. Like I've had people ask me some pretty obnoxious questions that they're clearly not scared of.
Those people probably should have a little more fear.
Yeah. So I think it really depends on the person.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think there's also, because of things like the Indian Act, we're from about like 1860 to 1951 when it was appealed. All cultural ceremonies were outlawed, all dances, all spiritual practice. So there's already kind of something holding that back and holding back that knowledge. And then again, this is like, it really intertwines with Indigenous identity and existence. And in these regions, when you look at something like the 60s scoop and like residential schools and things that were really pulling people out of their culture and really enabling regions like Niagara to exist without that piece of history. And I think that's a problem, is to talk about these two things separately, where in Europe, we really talk about everything all together. We talk about art being informed by politics and wine being informed by wars. And we really put it all together, where in Canada, for some reason, we have this mentality of being like, yeah, and then we saw this great region and we thought, shit, let's grow some grapes. And that's really not the case. Like, that's really not how it works. And so I don't know if it's because oftentimes Canadians want to act like stuff with Indigenous issues like residential school systems and the Indian Act and status laws didn't happen. I don't know if it's the lack of knowledge about them, because a lot of people didn't know about residential schools until the Truth and Reconciliation Act. It could be a combination of things. It could also be a pretty insidious anti-Indigenous racism. And I think we want to kind of talk about Canadian wine regions as being amazing. And for some reason, it's very okay that European wine regions are amazing because of war and because of conflict, but not in Canada.
Also, I think there's a mono thing. It's like, we don't think about appellations with wine. Ah, it's just all Ontario wine. Or when we think about Indigenous, I can't even say that word, communities. They're all the same. Oh, they got weird names, but they're all the same. Yeah. We sort of have this mono thought when it comes to, I think, probably the way a lot of people view the Indigenous community and the way we view Ontario wine.
Yeah, and I think a really good example of that, to bring it back to the LCBO, is when the LCBO was formed, you couldn't purchase alcohol without a permit. So you had to have a permit up until about the 60s. They moved that out for like a purchase order form, but before that you had to have a permit. And to have a permit, you had to be a Canadian citizen. A status Indian was not a Canadian citizen. So we were in the same line as known drunkards who also couldn't have a permit. So this kind of perpetuates this idea that Indigenous people have a problem with alcohol, which is not true. But the reason that this existed and the reason that status existed was to force assimilation of Indigenous people. So if you wanted to purchase alcohol, you could give up your status. You could become disenfranchised. And if you went to war, like for example, World War II, you could drink alcohol overseas, not in Canada, but overseas. And they sent out a memo at the end of the war to remind people that status Indians who had fought in the war still could not purchase or drink alcohol. So you also couldn't get veterans benefits from going to the war until you became disenfranchised and gave up your status. So there's all these things that kind of work against Indigenous people and their relationship in alcohol to create this myth and to kind of remove them from the ability to enjoy it. You could drink beer in a bar, but you couldn't purchase it to take home. So what would happen is because you weren't able to be publicly drunk, you could drink in a bar. And then if you went home, the RCMP could arrest you for being drunk on reserve because the reserves were dry. And then eventually you were able to petition to get a wet reserve where you could bring alcohol in or purchase alcohol, things like that. But it's really kind of set up to remove everything enjoyable to force you to give up your status to become a Canadian citizen. It's a way of, truly a way of tracking to see how many Indigenous people are quote unquote left. And now we're created this weird kind of imbalance in that where everybody wants to know if I am status. And if I am status, then I'm a real Indian and I'm a real native, to use things.
Oh, God.
So it's really bizarre, the value that's placed on that. So to be a status Indian, you could not get legal counsel up until 1951. You couldn't retain legal counsel. You couldn't own land, so you would give it up to purchase land. And so if we're going to talk about land in Niagara and all of the trees in Niagara, I think there's about four as it's continued to expand over that region, one of the first ones being in 1964. I don't understand how we look at Canadian wine and don't kind of talk about these things and kind of get into the history of the region. And oftentimes regions are respected because of history. I think Canadian loses on the stage because of the lack of history. We romance the history of European wines. There's a lot happening here. There's a lot to learn about where your wine is coming from, but we just don't talk about it.
This podcast, I do a lot of trying to big up the Appalachians here, but before we go there, I need to go back. Because, you know, one thing I appreciate about this is I'm learning a bunch here. So if it was 1955 and you were Indigenous, you were an Indigenous individual, you could not purchase wine from the LCBO unless you gave up your Indigenous status.
So after 49, you could, if I'm remembering this timeline correctly. There's a really great book and website resource that I will send you and you can put in people to read. It's called Punch Drunk. It's history of the LCBO as a surveillance state. It's really, really great.
Even after the Second World War, if you're Indigenous and you fought on the beaches of Normandy and you came home, you could not go to the LCBO unless you gave up.
And I'm sure you've heard this rumor, just to quickly put this aside, because I'm sure people are thinking about it as they're listening. But there is a whole big thing about how if you are a status woman and you married a non-Indigenous man, you lost your status. If you were a non-status man, or sorry, other way around, if you were a Indigenous man and you married a non-Indigenous woman, she would gain status. So there's this kind of myth that we've perpetuated now saying that, like, there's all these people who are not Indigenous who have status because of this law, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That was a deterrent for non-Indigenous women to not marry Indigenous men, because you would not be a Canadian citizen and your children would not be a Canadian citizen. But if a Canadian man married a non-Indigenous woman, his kids still, quote unquote, count. They are still Canadian. They're Canadian citizens. They don't have to go through all this legislation of the Indian Act. So there's not this thing where non-Indigenous people were marrying Indigenous men and getting all of these benefits. People really view status as being a benefit, but it kind of is like a dog tag system. So if you wanted to vote, if you wanted to get legal counsel, if you wanted to get your veterans benefits, if you wanted to purchase alcohol for your home, you couldn't up until the 60s. So there's no interaction with Indigenous people and the kind of the Canadian wine scene that would have been starting to come up at this time, because you're not allowed to consume any of it, but it's all happening on your land. So it really kind of pushes you out of the conversation and allows for this whitewashing of Canadian wine, and allows for the consumption of wine to be viewed as something that's highbrow and civilized and not for Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. It's very bizarre when you look back at the things that were allowed and things that were not allowed. And a quick example, just to remind people how recent this is, because 1960s is not that long ago.
Nope.
Even before that, in the 1930s, my grandfather grew up in Thunder Bay, my maternal grandfather. So he grew up believing that First Nations people were not the same species as Canadian citizens. And so for his daughter to marry an Indigenous man and have kids, that's a really big 180 to do in your lifetime. And he was wonderful. He loved us so much. Like, I don't want to paint a picture that he didn't. But that's a whole lot of information to process about a group of people that you're coexisting with. So we have a lot of work to do. And I think with the amount that we're starting to really champion Canadian wine and food, this is a great time to start including Indigenous people in that.
Yeah. If we're going to start highlighting Canadian food, Canadian wine, if we're going to start highlighting appellations, I think highlighting appellations is important because it gives the Canadian wine higher status when you know, oh, it's from this part, so it will have these characteristics. But if it's 10 kilometers this way, you know, there'll be some differences with it. If you can then marry that with, okay, now here's the history and how it relates to the Indigenous communities that were here, not only does that provide education, but B, it provides more context, perspective, and also, again, adds some gravitas to the glass of wine you're drinking. It feels win-win.
Yeah, it does. And I think, like I've said this a few times before in other places, but, you know, we're all really familiar with, like, land acknowledgements before meetings and things like that, where people started off by doing land acknowledgement, but they're really absent in hospitality, but everything we're getting is from the land. Even if it's something that's being imported in, it has traveled across this Canadian land to get here, to get to this restaurant. So bringing in that Italian wine is still something that exists on Indigenous land. And I know this is kind of maybe a little bit hippy-dippy, to quote my father, but I view roads almost as kind of like a virus spread. Like, you see all of a sudden these lines coming all across Canada. So the trade that's happening and the import goods that are getting there and arriving to the restaurant for you to enjoy that glass of Riesling like I am now, still has interacted with the land in some way. So why in hospitality are we not doing land acknowledgements? Are we not thanking the land that we're privileged to cook food on and make food on and serve and be sustained by and exist? That industry really never does it. It's crazy to me. Like, not in wine education, not in agriculture, not in food. And you're starting to see them now, like Benjamin Bridge in Nova Scotia has a really great land acknowledgement on their site. I think that's important, is educating the people about where you are. And appellations is one thing, but an appellation is a white colonial construct. Like, there is a whole other relationship that land has had to include in the education of that appellation.
Yeah, no, very well. No, it's very well said. It's great. Like, you know, cheers to that, as you can't see it, but Charlotte's pouring. But I've been pouring a couple times as well. So for the listeners, you know, I'm the one who really needs help. I wasn't going to drink. I see you have a glass. And then I'm like the greedy kid where the older brother gets candy. It's like, where's my candy? You know,
I figured, you know what, if I'm doing a wine podcast, I should have a nice glass of wine while I'm doing it.
I'll be honest. I've done some with people over in Europe and it's like 9 a.m. my time and they've got a glass. And I'm like, why can't I have some Rioja right now? I'm like, maybe Tempranillo at 9:15 in the morning isn't the best thing.
Oh, if you work in wine like I do, you do a lot of early morning tasting. So
It's true. I remember when I used to work for a wine consignment company, doing tastings at 9 in the morning. And I learned pretty early on, David Ramey makes some great Chardonnay from California. You better spit, because you got a whole day ahead of you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually, it was Milan Week in Toronto this week, and I had some early morning tastings for that. So thankfully I was off work. I could kind of slowly enjoy myself later on in the day. But a lot of the times, because we work in this industry, if you got to work at night, tastings are more likely to happen in the morning. So
kind of. The 11 a.m. wines of Italy at the ROM. I love those events. Yeah. When I used to do morning radio, it'd be great. I'd be done at 10 a.m., come home, have a quick shower, and then I'm at the art gallery trying 30 different types of white wine from Portugal. It was great.
Yeah, it's a fun world to work through.
Yep. Before we end, first, what are you drinking now? Have you had anything interesting recently or stuff beyond, of course, Northern Italian Riesling, which is such a trope, so boring. I mean, my God, you know, why not break out of the stereotype and try something interesting?
What am I drinking these days? I drink a lot of my own stuff from Ascari, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, then promote. Promote Ascari. Promote some of the great stuff that's over there. I am so pro restaurant, and I love Ascari. It's a great place.
Yeah, we have a really fun kind of Lambrusco, not Lambrusco. It's a sparkling Barbera. Mm-hmm. So if you like Lambrusco, you might like this. And I've been drinking some of that as the weather kind of gets a little cooler. I'm honestly working towards my CMS right now. So I was supposed to write the exam earlier this year, but COVID had other plans. So we are currently waiting to see when that's going to happen. But I've been drinking a lot of testable stuff, which is definitely fun. But then when you're able to not drink testable, you drink weird stuff like I do right now. So
yeah,
really enjoying a lot of Shannon, to be honest. Nicer wine than I deserve to drink right now, but that's what I've been going for.
By the way, Lambrusco, I find people either love it or they hate it. There's not a lot of middle ground with Lambrusco or something. Yeah. Eh, I could drink some today. Like, it's one or the other.
Well, you know what? Lambrusco used to be the most imported wine to the U.S. in the 70s. It was huge. And it was much sweeter than it is right now. But if you ever want a really, really great laugh, the brand was called Riuniti. And they have the most amazing commercials from the 70s for Riuniti Lambrusco on YouTube. It is hilarious. So I think there's a lot of people who still view Lambrusco as what it used to be, of being very, very sweet. But the newer Lambruscos that are being made right now are awesome. I think I also have an affinity to it because I have a wine importer who comes to visit me from Italy, and he's from Emilia Romagna. And every time he sits at the bar, I'm like, I swear to God, if this guy says to me like, Charlotte, come, let's go, we make Lambrusco, I'm out of here. Like, but no, he brings some really, really great wine, and Lambrusco is a really food friendly wine. So, but you got to love it. Like, it is, yeah. It is my ball.
Yeah. Oh no. I remember bringing Lambrusco and at an event, and I was the only one by the end of the night. I was the one who basically drank the entire bottle. Promote again. Tell people information if they want to find out more about the full plate, about Ascari. I appreciate you taking the time. Time is the most valuable commodity on this planet. So please feel free to shamelessly plug whatever.
Yeah. So you can go to thefullplate.ca to get full access to all of our services. Our Instagram is, I believe, @the.fullplate. I post a lot of stuff about wine and indigenous land rights. So you can follow me too. I'll put my Instagram in the bio, but yeah, check out the full plate. Come see some of the stuff that we're doing. We have a lot of projects upcoming right now that I'm really excited about that are getting fleshed out. And yeah, we'll do some more wine education. We do actually have some WSET wine level, like comparative courses online. So they're curated by a WSET 3 grad. So we've put those together for people if they want to get some wine education for free and not go through all that. So that is there too. But yeah, check it out.
Perfect. Hey, Charlotte, really appreciate this. This has been fun. It's been educational, and it was an excuse to open a bottle of Chardonnay. So I appreciate you joining me.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed it. We'll talk soon.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.